Israel's religion was not Judaism. Modern terminology today is so mixed up that we have some of the commonly used terms in the Bible that we can't use but in certain circles because people don't understand them the same way. You go to one circle and you use a terminology and it'll mean something to them, and in another circle it'll mean something totally different. And so, for one thing today, I would like to look at some terms and help to define them. And I've listed five, and this is just a few, but it has to do with the subject of Israel's real religion. Number one, the terminology, the law of Moses. Number two, the law and the prophets. Number three, Judaism. Number four, tradition of the elders. And number five, Phariseeism. Now I think if we can identify those a little bit, that it will help us get a better handle on what the problem is in Christianity concerning the mix-up of all these traditions and all of these terms. Modern Christianity is confused to the point that it takes these ill-defined terms and uses them to form a belief, and then if you start out wrong, it's obvious that you're going to continue in the wrong direction. Spiritual or religious confusion is really the bottom line to all the troubles that our country or any country can fall into. Spiritual confusion or religious confusion. Now, when that happens, then the door is wide open to national sins of every kind. And when that happens, then the door is wide open to overthrow by any kind of a foreign power or religion. And we see this actually happening today in America. America's spiritual confusion is evidenced by the fact that Americans can't make up their mind about hardly anything anymore. Confusion is everywhere. Now, we hear people talking about conspiracies and so forth. And I believe that there are conspiracies. I don't know that I could define them and describe them to you at this point. But there is definitely a conspiracy against the spirit. That is flesh working against the spirit. And a lot of times, this conspiracy works without common agreement. It just happens to turn out that those who are working against the spirit happen to be working for the same goal. But Americans today have trouble making up their minds on most anything, particularly religion. We can't decide here in America whether we're a Christian nation or not. The Supreme Court has decided it, but we as the people can't make up our minds. The Supreme Court has, in at least one occasion, declared that America was a Christian nation, and yet we don't see America acting as a Christian nation all the way. Many dumb Americans like to think in terms of religious freedom. Now, religious freedom is drawn into our Constitution, but not in terms of the sort of freedom that we hear about in most of the pulpits today. Not in terms of freedom for any immoral religion to come in from the outside and usurp Christianity. That's not the kind of religious freedom that was implied there, nor in the Word of God. The type of religious freedom that we hear preached today is a kind that would give equal rights to any kind of pagan religion that would come in. Equal rights. Equal time, equal rights, right across the board. The ultimate result of that kind of reasoning is equal integration. Now, I'm speaking of integration in terms of mixing up everything. All things must be integrated in terms of this pagan theology, pagan idealism. Religions, morals, Bibles. The Christian Bible isn't the only Bible that you notice today when you go into a bookstore. You see all sorts of Bibles there from other religions. The integration of cultures and standards, the integration of right and wrong, good and evil, clean and unclean, all of that under the pagan idea should be mixed together so that there is no defining difference between them. And they say then that that is where the strength lies. And Jesus Christ says that that is where death lies. In terms of total integration, we have a word that comes to my mind that we hear coming from a lot of different pagan philosophers. It's called genocide. And we have a lot of people being blamed for genocide. But if you think about it, when you totally integrate and amalgamate everything, you have mass genocide. You have no culture left the way that it was before. Everything is all one culture. You have no race left the way that it was before. You have all one race. And you have no religion the way that it was before. You have all one religion. That's the ultimate goal of paganism. That's what you see happening in America today. That's why Christianity can't seem to get its feet on the ground enough to push these ungodly religions back. Because we aren't separating ourselves from those type of things. The amalgamation of opposites is one of, if not perhaps the most prime and basic rule of paganism. And another word for paganism is Babylonian religion. Biblically speaking, that term Babylonian religion is paganism. The amalgamation of opposites, as it enters into our society, it weakens. It weakens our society. And nearly all paganism believes in that theory, in one form or another. You can even see it in their symbolisms. The little diagrams that they draw that represent their particular belief, you can see the amalgamation of opposites. Just for an example, the six-pointed star that they call the Star of David, the representation of Judaism, you have two opposing pyramids or triangles superimposed over one another. And that symbolism then brings out their idea of the amalgamation of opposites. Is there any wonder why we see integration in everything around us today and why we can't seem to get past that wall? True Christianity leads toward just the opposite. It leads toward separation and refinement. For instance, we can look at a reference in the book of Revelation that talks about refining by fire. Book of Revelation chapter 3. And I'll read verse 18. Jesus Christ here is giving this counsel. I counsel thee to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that thou mayest be rich. Now that's a very brief statement, but within that statement lies the whole concept of Christianity and the workings of the kingdom of Christ on this earth. That is, to come into darkness and spread light. That is, to come into unrefined society and refine it. Judge it and refine it down to where you have gold. Gold tried in the fire. Now, the pagan doctrine that would be the opposite of that would be stir it up and mix it back up. Don't let it get refined. Stir it back up and mix it together. Amalgamate it with something else. Don't let it be pure. Verses 15 and 16. I know thy works, that thou art neither hot nor cold. There you go. We have two opposites there, don't we? Hot and cold. I would that thou were cold or hot. Now there he suggests that even better than amalgamation would be remain cold rather than just become warm. You see, when you integrate cold and hot, you become warm. And he doesn't like that. He says, because you were lukewarm or amalgamated or integrated or unrefinable, because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Now, you perhaps wouldn't pick up that connotation from that if you weren't already thinking in those terms, but it applies. Turn now to 2 Corinthians, and we'll read from chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, starting in verse 14. We're talking about separation here. The Christian ideal of separating from evil. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God, as God hath said, I will dwell in them, I will walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore come out from among them, and be ye separate, not integrated, not amalgamated, but separate, saith the Lord. And touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you. I will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. You see, amalgamation is preached on every front in terms of humanism, in terms of paganism, from any pulpit that you may hear it from, whether it's a pagan pulpit or a pseudo-Christian pulpit. And it always says, tolerance for what? Tolerance for evil. Don't be a goody-goody. Don't strive to be good to the point where you offend the evil people. That won't help. They would have us amalgamate with the evil to the point that we are neither good or evil. We're just somewhere in between. That's the weakness that Israel has in her this day. That's the weakness of America. We're not hot or cold. We're somewhere in between. As long as we're susceptible to that kind of thinking, the amalgamation idea, as long as we're susceptible to that, we will never become pure gold in God's fire. Of course, he can cause this to pass, and he is. And we will change, whether we want to or not. But the amalgamation theory is going to have to go. Paganism teaches us to mix everything. And if we don't subscribe to that, they call us narrow-minded. Narrow-minded, and perhaps they call us a fanatic. I don't mind being a fanatic for my Lord. So, names don't bother me anymore, as long as I know that I'm following my Lord. Living in Christ's kingdom involves identifying the difference between good and evil, and making the separate distinction. Hebrews chapter 5, verse 14. But strong meat belongeth to them that are full of age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. You know, if we discern good and evil nowadays, we're called a bigot. The people who don't seem to be concerned about the difference, seem to get along real well. They're called good names. Today's religion in America is a homogenized religion. They take all of the religions and put it into one thing and shoot it through a nozzle and homogenize it, just like you homogenize milk. And the result when it comes out is that you don't have any one of the particulars that went into it to begin with. You have a totally new product. Now that's paganism. You see, there's a false assumption, and maybe this comes from childhood or a lack of wisdom, I don't know which, but I can remember thinking along the lines of this, that the pagans are people who know who the real God is, but they prefer to worship the other God that they have over here made out of gold or made out of stone or made out of wood. You see, that's not the case at all. Pagans believe that their God is the God. They believe that that is the God of this world. And they worship it as such. They don't know that the real God is over here. Therefore, Israel is at fault for not shining to the point that they can see the true God. And of course, that's Israel's reason for being in this world. To be the servant of God and to be a light to the nations for him. And we can't convert all of the pagans all at once. But we certainly have to convert the Israelites first, don't we? In the nature of this amalgamation idea, the mixing of everything, what you have is the obvious attempt to forestall refinement and forestall judgment, you might say. We all sort of have the knowledge that judgment is coming, don't we? Even the pagans, I think, believe that judgment's coming. But by keeping things mixed up, by keeping them amalgamated and where there is no real discernment between one or the other, they can forestall this judgment because who are you to judge me? You're as bad as I am, right? That's their idea. That's their way of thinking. Maybe you've had that said to you a time or two. So as long as the real working Christianity is kept suppressed where it can't be seen, then the judgment, they think, is being forestalled. Of course, God works in ways that they can't forestall. Equal amounts of Eastern mystic religions with our Western religion. Do you see that today? Equal amounts of Buddha with Christ today. You see that, at least in places in America. Lukewarm situations where real judgment and real discernment isn't taking place. In fact, the Christian world today is so weak and confused that, and this is about the ultimate confusion in my way of thinking, is that they call the religion of Israel Judaism. And we're back to that subject again. I said all of that to get to this point. The confusion that is a part of the reason that we hear from so many pulpits today that Judaism is the religion of Israel is caused by the weakening of paganism in the first place. Of course, Judaism is one of the foremost paganisms that's weakening us. If we can prove that Judaism is not the religion of Israel, then we should be able to clear up a lot of confusion. Now, it would take more time than this one sermon to prove it, probably to everybody's satisfaction, but we're going to talk about a few things and possibly satisfy a few people. Judaism is a completely different religion than the religion given by Moses. It comes from a different place, has a different intent, and it's worshipped by different people. The biblical terms, the law of Moses, the law and the prophets, Judaism, tradition of the elders, and Phariseeism, with the exception of Judaism, all of those words can be found in the Bible. And so they mean something. So let's see what we can come up with. The law of Moses and the law and the prophets go together as describing one religion. The law of Moses, technically, is the first five books of the Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. That's what's generally referred to as the law of Moses. The law and the prophets refer to all of the books of the Old Testament. And so we have, in those two terms, and even in one term, the law and the prophets, we have the religion of Israel described, or at least a terminology for the religion of Israel. We don't have it totally described. To describe that religion, you have to read the Bible. And it's not a religion that's bound up in ritual for the appeasement of a God who longs to be appeased. In terms of what we think of religions, it may not even be a religion. This is a law for society, a direction for humans. It's a way of living. It's not a ritual whereby we can appease or gain the benefit of our God, because we have His benefit to begin with. He's trying to help us learn how to live amongst one another. The difference between that thinking and the thinking of Judaism is that Judaism tries to appease a God through doing things in a ritualistic manner. And if you have the right ritual, and if you do it on the right day, and if you say the right words, then you get what you want. It's a sorcery. It's a trying to manipulate. It's not seeking after truth and living after it. Israel's religion, very simply, taught us how to live together, godly. Judaism teaches us that we have a God who is far removed from us, and we have to go to certain extremes to reach Him. It's a different God, and it's a different religion. Judaism, in terms of the way that it's used today, is actually the same thing as what you read in the Bible in the terms of Phariseeism, the religion of the Pharisees. The tradition of the elders is a spoken tradition, at least at the time of the Bible was written. It was a spoken tradition a secret tradition amongst the Jews. And it was passed down from priest or rabbi to priest or rabbi. And it wasn't something that was open to the general public, but it was a secret doctrine. It's beginning to be opened now, and if you want to go look for a book on the Kabbalah, that's a C-A-B-B-A-L-A-H, the Kabbalah, you can read some of these ancient secret traditions or printing it, and it's being published at times. In fact, I have one with me today. I'm going to read a bit out of it. This book I picked up from a book club that I was in, and it's published by Bell Publishing Company in New York, and it's available to the public. So the tradition of the elders was the occult Jewish religion that we hear spoken of by Christ and referred to as the tradition of the elders. We shouldn't think in terms of just legalism when we think about Pharisees. The Pharisees were not just legal people, not just legalistic. They were corrupt and evil and worshiping a complete different law system than Moses gave. The confusion between the religion of Israel and the religion of the Jews has brought many people to condemning Israel's religion on the basis that they condemn Judaism or Phariseeism. And you see, you have a false premise there. If they're two different religions, you can't condemn one for what the other one does. And yet we see that the Pharisees did bad things, and therefore some then assume that they were doing that according to the laws given in the Old Testament. So therefore the Old Testament's bad, the law is bad, and ultimately the God of the Old Testament is bad because he's the one that gave those laws. Well, that's Judaism's idea, not ours. Now, there is a lot of condemnation in the Bible about Phariseeism. This is only a part of that. Matthew chapter 16, verse 6. Then Jesus said to them, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees." Now, Jesus was talking to his disciples here, and he told them to beware the leaven of the Pharisees. Verse 12, then, explains what he meant. They ask him what he meant, and he explained a bit further, and then it says in verse 12, "Then understood they how that he bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees." You see, it's the doctrine. If the Pharisees' doctrine was the doctrine of Israel, why would Christ tell them to beware of it? Okay? Turn to chapter 23, verse 13. Here we have a quote from Jesus again. "But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for ye neither go in yourselves, neither suffer ye them that are entering to go in. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer, therefore ye shall receive the greater damnation. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye compass the sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he is made, ye make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves." Now, as I'm reading this, remember, he's describing a religion here. He's not saying, "Boy, you Pharisees aren't really practicing what you preach." He's not saying that. He's saying, "You are practicing exactly what you preach, and here is what's wrong with what you preach. Woe unto you, ye blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing, but whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he is a debtor. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye pay tithe and mint of anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye make clean the outside of the cup of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye are like the whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets." The only way that you can come to a good idea of what he's describing here is to study the Talmud. The Talmud is the Bible of the Jews, of Judaism. And when you study that Talmud and see what they believe in, then you can see that what Jesus is describing here is their religion. Now, is that the religion of Israel? No. That's not the religion that Moses gave. Let's look at the tradition of the elders now. In Matthew chapter 15, we have a reference to that. In verse 1, "Then came to Jesus scribes and Pharisees, which were of Jerusalem, saying, Why do thy disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread. But he answered and said unto them, Why do ye also transgress the commandment of God by your tradition?" Now that's the tradition of the elders. That's transgressing the law of God. Verse 6, "Thus have ye made the commandment of God of none effect by your tradition. Ye hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, This people draweth nigh unto me with their mouth, and honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain they do worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." Now, the commandments given through Moses were not commandments of men. They're commandments of God. We're talking about two totally different systems. When you think of how vile the system was that Jesus found himself in there, you can see that he was actually tolerant by calling them hypocrites, by calling them vipers and brood of vipers. It could have been a lot worse, and it would have been justified in terms of their religion that they were practicing. Okay, now I want to read from this book that I brought. It's called the Kabbalah. And this is not the Kabbalah, but this is a book about the Kabbalah. This is from page 204. 40,000 returned to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel. A second immigration headed by Ezra took place under the reign of Artaxerxes about 70 years after the first one. During this interval, the religious forms of Zoroaster, now I guess I need to explain who Zoroaster was. The Jewish religion as we have it today and as it comes to us today is actually a part of Babylonian religion and a part of Zoroastrian religion. And if you're not familiar with the religion of Zoroaster, you need to look it up in your dictionary or, I mean, in your encyclopedia. He's an interesting fellow. And you find in studying the doctrines that he promulgated that the Christian doctrines and his doctrines are almost the same. I'm not talking about true Christian doctrines. I'm talking about Christian doctrines as we see it in Christendom today, practiced in this amalgamated form. The Orthodox Christian, or the Orthodox Christian doctrine, is so similar to the doctrine of Zoroaster that it would just amaze you. Okay, during this interval, the religious reform of Zoroaster had time to spread to all parts of the Babylonian Empire and to take deep roots in the minds of people. The Babylonian synagogue arose under the civil and religious hegemony of the leaders of the captivity, and it cooperated with the synagogue in Palestine toward the definite organization of rabbinic Judaism. And it speaks about Hillel the Babylonian. Hillel, of course, was one of the great teachers in Judaism. The same schools produced the Babylonian Talmud, the final and most complete expression of Judaism. We may conclude that no nation exerted so deep an influence on the Jews as the Persians. The Persians were the Zoroastrians. We may conclude that no nation exerted so deep an influence on the Jews as the Persians, that no moral power could have penetrated more deeply into the spirit than did the religions or the religious system of Zoroaster and its long procession of traditions and commentaries. Okay, I'm skipping over now to page 209. We can add to these beliefs a host of religious customs and practices. Now he goes through here and describes some of the beliefs of Zoroaster, and amongst these you have such things as the lake, the eternal burning lake of fire where people will be thrown into the eternal hell doctrine. We have the immortal soul doctrine. We have the evolution doctrine. We have many others that you read about in Orthodox Christianity. And like I said, it's really amazing to see the similarities. And he's been talking about these common beliefs. And they're prescribed by both Talmud and the Zend Avesta. The Zend Avesta is a book of Zoroaster, the religious book of Zoroaster. Thus the Parsi, now there's another interesting word. The Parsi is the word for the people who practice Zoroastrianism. Parsi and Pharisee is very similar, isn't it? Now I can't prove it, but I suspect there's a connection. And there are still some Parsis on the earth today. In fact, you can find them over in Asia, and I can't remember exactly the place now, but there is a small place, I think it's in China, where Parsiism is still practiced. Okay, thus the Parsi, on leaving his bed in the morning, may not take four steps without first girding his loins with a sacred belt which is called the Kosti, under the pretext that during that night he has been contaminated by contact with demons. He may not touch any part of his body before washing his hands and face three times. Now, any of you that have studied the Talmud recognize these things. It's the same thing. It's in the Talmud, the Jewish belief. We find the same duties based on the same reasons practiced by the followers of rabbinical law, except that the kosti is replaced by a garment of another shape. Both the disciples of Zoroaster and the followers of the Talmud consider themselves duty-bound to greet the moon at its first quarter with prayers and thanksgivings. The practices of defending the dead and the newborn from the demons who try to possess them are nearly the same in both religions. When a Parsi woman has been delivered of a child, a burning lamp or a fire is maintained in her room for 3 days and three nights. The Jews observe the same custom at death. The ceremony of keeping away the demon Lilith from the newborn is still more complicated, but the reason for it and a description of it are given in the book of Raziel. That's a book in the Talmud. Religion, that is to say, the civilization of ancient Persia, left numerous traces in all parts of Judaism, and its celestial mythology, represented by angels, and its infernal mythology, that's the doctrine of demons, finally, in the religious practices and in the actual rituals that they did. Okay, one more place. The book sums up on the very back page here. It says, the striking resemblances which we have found between this doctrine and the religious beliefs of the several sects of Persia, its numerous and remarkable points of similarity with the Zend Avesta, and traces that the religion of Zoroaster has left in all parts of Judaism, and the external relations between the Hebrews and their old teachers from before the Babylonian captivity, all of these force us to the conclusion that the material of the Kabbalah derived from the theology of the ancient Persians. Now, we know that part of Judaism came from Babylon. Now we find that part of Judaism came from Persia. You see, this is not the religion that came from Israel. All of this evidence points to that. In terms of what we call Judaism today, or it was called Phariseeism in the time of Jesus, Louis Finkelstein wrote a book called The Pharisees, The Sociological Background and Their Faith. And Louis Finkelstein is a Jewish rabbi. And he says in his writing that Judaism turned into Phariseeism. Phariseeism turned into Talmudism. Talmudism became medieval rabbinism, and medieval rabbinism became modern rabbinism. But throughout these changes in name, the spirit of the ancient Pharisee survives unaltered. Last March, when I was in Washington, D.C. with Pastor Emery, I took opportunity to go to the Library of Congress, and I found a book that I've been looking for there that is long out of print. And I was doing a study on the calendar, and what calendars Israel had, and what calendar we have, and what calendar the Jews had. And I'm still on that subject. I'm still on that study. But I found out some interesting things, and I took some quotes from that book. And surprisingly, not only were they under a different set of laws, they were under a different calendar at that time, too. And therefore, their rituals that they participated in, the days of the week that they kept, the days of the month that they kept, the type of things that they did, weren't on the same times that Israel kept them. Now that's an interesting thing. The Jewish calendar has the same names as the Babylonian calendar for the months. On page 11, paragraph 2, the author, by the way, the name of this book is Babylonian Monologies and the Semitic Calendars, and his name is Stephen Herbert Langdon. And on page 11 he says, "Here in our northern hemisphere there is an unbroken history of the religious calendars and monthly myths from the Sumerian calendars of 3000 BC before Babylonia, Judea, and Christianity to our own times. The Sumerian myths and festivals survived and determined the character of the church calendar of Babylonia, Assyria, which in turn gave Judaism its series of fixed festivals." You see, that's all aside from Israel. He says that my object in these lectures will be to trace the myths and festivals of the Nepurian calendar. That Nepurian calendar would be the Babylonian calendar, only it would be ancient Babylonian calendar. And that they finally prevailed over all other Sumerian, Akkadian, and Assyrian, and Western Semitic calendars, and became the monthly series of the Jewish church. Okay, here's another in page 18. "Backed by the almost universal adoption in business and transactions in the wide empires of Assyria and Babylonia, by the elaborate manner in which the Assyrians wrote the monologies," monologies means moons or calendars, the Babylonians kept their months by the moon, "monologies, with instructions for each day of the year, it completely supplanted the old Hebrew calendar after the second captivity." There it tells us where Israel lost its original calendar. Israel lost its calendar in the captivity. That makes sense when you think about it. The calendar that we see the Jews keeping was a calendar of Babylon. Okay, page 18, it says this: "It seems clear that the fixed Jewish festivals were taken directly from the great monologies and almanacs of Babylonia and Assyria, which in turn go back directly to Sumerians, to the Sumerians and to Nippur." On page 85, he says, "When did these rules originate? They were found only in the Assyrian promulgations of the church breviaries. But Babylonia and not Assyria exercised the principal influence upon Judea." Babylonia exercised influence on Judea. "The Jewish calendar was borrowed from Babylonia 2 centuries after Assyria fell in 612 BC. These rules undoubtedly date from the great classical period of Babylonian civilization, the age of Hammurabi. The institution of the rest days," now here we get to the Sabbath, "the institution of the rest day enforced so rigidly that even the sick may not be attended by a physician is then of great antiquity in both Babylonia and Assyria." It's not an Israel doctrine that you can't go to a doctor on the Sabbath. That's a Babylonian doctrine. "The Pharisees rebuked the disciples of Jesus for plucking ears of corn on the Sabbath. The crowning offense of Jesus in the eyes of the Pharisees was the healing of the man with the palsied hand on the Sabbath." Now that, of course, was the Jewish Sabbath at that time. "And they watched him whether he would heal on the Sabbath day that they may accuse him." That's a quotation from the Bible. "These strict rules about healing and working, traveling on certain days do not belong to early Hebrew religion." Now I'm still reading from this book that was written in 1935, I believe it was. "They are post-exilic and rather obviously under Babylonian influence. Josephus, who wrote in the New Testament times, also says that it was unlawful for us to travel either on the Sabbath or on a feast day." These are rules known in Babylonia. You study the Babylonian traditions, that's where you find these rules. Ashurbanipal in the 7th century BC promulgated a calendar with a definite scheme of the seventh day week, with a 7-day week, a regulation of the month by which all men were to rest on days number 7, 14, 19, 21, 28, on which neither the sick could be cured, nor a man in difficulty consult a prophet. None may travel, and fasting was enforced. Okay, a couple more quotes here while I'm doing this. On the 26th of Erisamna, that's the name of a month, he, the king, shall recite a penitential poem. Let him release a prisoner or he will come to harm. The custom of releasing a prisoner also occurs in the 16th of Adar and on some day in Tammuz. The Jewish custom fell at Passover, Nisan 14 through 22nd, and is mentioned in the New Testament at the trial of Jesus by Pilate. Ye have a custom that I should release unto you one at Passover. No similar law was mentioned in Hebrew. You see, there's another Babylonian custom that's not a custom of Israel. The Jewish Feast of Lights comes from the Babylonian custom of lighting braziers, and I think that falls on this December 25th. Any conceivable act of man in any of the 354 days of the lunar year was governed by this complicated calendar. 354 days in the Babylonian calendar governed by the moons. Moses' calendar was a solar calendar with 365 days a year governed by the calendar, not by the moons. It was a set of 12 months of 30 days to the month and then 5 days added at the end of the year. And it was consistent year in and year out. It wasn't governed by the moons. Now, we've discovered several differences in Judaism and the religion of Israel. The term Judaism signifies not a race of people or a tribe, as of the tribe of Judah. The term Judaism describes a religion of an area. The area in the Old Testament was called Judah after the exile. It was called Judah after they returned. In the New Testament, it was called Judea. So there you have Judea or Judaism. It's the religion of the area and anybody that's there. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 3. And here we have a reference to the closest reference that I could find in the Bible to the term Judaism. The word Judaism doesn't appear in the Bible, but we have this reference in chapter 3 of Revelation that just seems to describe Judaism. Chapter 3, verse 9. Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet, and to know that I have loved thee. Okay, turn back one chapter to chapter 2, verse 9. I know thy works, and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. This obviously refers to the taking over of the religion of the original people from the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, taking it over and being overpowered by those who say they are Jews but were not. Later on, the term Jew came to cover anybody who lived in that area. This is talking about the way that it came to pass. And it describes Judaism as the synagogue of Satan. Now that's the closest I can come to a description in the Bible of Judaism. If you want to know what religion the Jews practiced at the time of Christ, look at what religion they practice today. Judaism today is the same as it was at the time of Christ. When you see Christ condemning Judaism or Phariseeism, then he's not condemning Israelism. It's a different thing. Judaism is based on the Talmud, not on the Bible. The Talmud then is based on Babylon and Zoroastrian views, not the Bible. The rituals in Israel of old were different than the rituals of the Jews. They were held on different days than the days of the Jews. They had a different calendar. They had different feasts. They had different almost everything. There are many more proofs that I don't have time to go into, but I think maybe the point has been made. The tradition of the elders, Judaism is the synagogue of Satan. Christianity is certainly not founded in that. Christianity is not founded in Judaism by any means of the imagination. Christianity is founded in the true religion of Israel. Jesus condemned Judaism. He didn't.